I'm Robin Young. It's here and now it's the weather. As federal and state officials scramble to control the BP oil slick making its way to Louisiana shores, forecasters are predicting storms will prevent crews from skimming the oil. The Navy has sent 66,000 feet of inflatable boom and 7 skimming systems to Gulfport, Mississippi. Billy Nungesser is president of Plaquemines Parish, where the oil has reportedly reached the shoreline of the Mississippi Delta.
We can't sit and wait for this stuff to come ashore and say we did our best. That's not good enough. This has the potential to destroy all of coastal Louisiana and even the beaches in Mississippi and Alabama.
We'll have a couple reports for you today. We'll start with Jeff Ball of the Wall Street Journal in Louisiana. Jeff, people 90 miles from this spill say they're smelling it. What are you hearing about the weather?
Well, clearly the weather's a problem. Yesterday, the authorities were unable to do controlled burns on the oil spill because of choppy seas. There are reports that the weather is bad today and that that's pushing oil over the booms that they've laid. So this is not something that the authorities need on top of the spill itself.
Right. It goes from bad to worse because it could push the water further into these fragile ecosystems. But what about the response? We're hearing reports of sightings of Black Hawk helicopters in the area and also the Air Force standing by.
The federal government is pulling out the stops here. What's becoming clear is that people didn't realize at the start of this how severe this was going to become and how much oil there was going to be. And to a large degree, people are learning here as they go along. The federal government had a pretty extensive press conference yesterday in Washington where they made clear they'll spend any amount of money to try to fix this. The bill, by the way, will ultimately go to BP. But as you say, airplanes, ships, booms, a lot of novel sorts of things, to say nothing of what they're trying to do deep beneath the water.
Well, let's stay with just the planes, because what might they do? We're understanding they're getting ready to drop chemicals.
The reports are that they're getting ready to drop chemical dispersants to try to essentially eat away at some of the oil. The effectiveness of that will depend to some degree on how choppy the seas are.
Well, you mentioned that people are sort of not making this up as they go along, but learning as they go along. Now, we've had a lot of questions from listeners. First of all, how is it that BP could go from thinking 1,000 barrels a day was leaking from this undersea well to 5,000 barrels a day? Who gets to decide how much is leaking? How much oversight is there of this BP examination of this?
There are two answers to that question. The answer to the question of who gets to decide is essentially the federal government at the end of the day. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, known as NOAA, has people who are expert in monitoring oil spills and essentially tracking spills once they've occurred and then helping figure out what to do about them. And the reason that people thought initially it was about 1,000 barrels a day and then switched to 5,000 barrels a day is twofold. This is somewhat unprecedented, this spill, in the depth of the spill and the amount of oil that's coming out very, very deep beneath the sea. And what people say is that they initially thought there was only one leak way down there and then discovered more. It's essentially a tangled jumble of metal down there and therefore difficult to figure out exactly where the oil is coming from and from how many places it's coming. Number two, when there was the initial estimate of 1,000 barrels a day, what happened is that NOAA has people and the rest of the federal government have people who are flying in helicopters over the oil spill. They quickly determined that the amount of oil that they were seeing from those helicopters was much more than would be explained by 1,000 barrels a day. One last thing, what all these people say is that none of this is exact. What they're looking for at this point is essentially orders of magnitude. They want to know in the thousands of barrels, not in the tens of barrels, and there will be a much more strict accounting, they say, later on.
By the way, Jeff, BP is also saying it's a different kind of oil. It's a thin, almost the color of tea, not as dangerous as the oil, for instance, in the Exxon Valdez spill. But then we're also hearing that this could be worse than the Exxon Valdez.
Yeah, I mean, one hears different versions of events. Clearly, it's a different sort of an oil. I think BP's argument is that because it's a lighter crude, it's likelier to evaporate. More of the particularly volatile parts of the oil are likely to evaporate, probably easier to clean up. Other people say that this sort of crude is more difficult to clean up because it mixes with the water more completely. One analogy that I heard that I thought was interesting was that it's like taking salad oil and salad dressing and shaking it up. And so to the degree that the oil dissolves in the bottle or appears to dissolve in the bottle of salad dressing, it's harder to isolate that oil. But clearly it's a different grade of oil than was the case in Valdez.
Jeff Ball of the Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
And we'll have another report from the Gulf in our second half hour. Right now, let's go to the Kennedy Library. Recently, I moderated an evening at the John F. Kennedy Library here in Boston. Hundreds gathered to listen to historian Ellen Fitzpatrick read letters written to Jackie Kennedy after her husband's assassination.
I thought perhaps you would know by this letter that there are those who will never forget your husband and who will always miss him.
That was from Janice Crabtree of Dallas, Texas. Another came from Catherine Dowd Jackson of Pinehurst, North Carolina.
Dear beloved one, I know you are somewhat surprised, shocked with the last, and griefed to what happened to such a great man, husband, father, and son, and father of our country. And I know you are surprised to learn I am a Negro woman. But as I sit here and I try to put words in words my feeling, I hope you will feel a spot in your heart for me.
Ellen Fitzpatrick tracked down Mrs. Jackson's family and found that her grandson was in the area, a lieutenant colonel and national security fellow attending the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard.
And I think the colonel is here tonight. It's Colonel Goins. Can you stand?
So many stories. Fred Berman's family didn't even know that he'd written this letter from St. Louis when he was already an old man.
It's addressed to Mrs. John F. Kennedy and her two sweet children. Dear sis, this is a letter with grief and sorry from the bottom of my heart and sympathy to you. I am happy to write a few lines. I hope this letter will give you and your children a spirit. And we loved you all. God bless you. So Mr. Berman's family is here. I think we're looking at a granddaughter.
We had no idea that he sent this letter, and you can tell by the writings in the letter that he was not a, you know, an educated man, but he felt such conviction to write this letter and send it off. And I can't tell you how many times we've toasted Fred. So I just want to say thank you from the bottom of our heart. This has been just phenomenal for us. So thank you.
Thank you.
These letters, thousands of them, had been boxed up for 47 years after that awful November day. How Ellen Fitzpatrick came to find and research them for her new book, Letters to Jackie, is a story that starts with her childhood memory of a television broadcast.
The middle of January, she went on television. She was thanking the country for the first 800,000. It was her first public appearance.
Let's watch.
I want to take this opportunity to express my appreciation for the hundreds of thousands of messages. Whenever I can bear to, I read them. All his bright light gone from the world. All of you who have written to me know how much we all loved him and that he returned that love in full measure. It is my greatest wish that all of these letters be acknowledged. They will be, but it will take a long time to do so. But I know you will understand. Each and every message is to be treasured, not only for my children, but so that future generations will know how much our country and people in other nations thought of him. Your letters will be placed with his papers in the library to be erected in his memory along the Charles River in Boston, Massachusetts. It will be, we hope, not only a memorial to President Kennedy, but a living center of study of the times in which he lived.
I was trying to think about how I might be able to find out how Americans viewed President Kennedy in his own time. What would be a good source? And it just came into my mind, what about those condolence letters that she received that would have been written right in the moment?
And what broadly do they tell us about America at that time?
It's a paradox because on the one hand, it's a time of greater innocence. Remember, this is before Watergate. It's before the escalation of the Vietnam War. And so there's a kind of faith in the president.
Well, there's also, as you remind us, I mean, there were people who hated JFK
yes.
at the time. And even some of those who write very civilly in almost a quaint language that you don't hear anymore. There's a civility. There are letters. We don't write letters anymore.
Yes.
There's a language that's different.
Yes. Even people who began by saying, gee, you know, I'm sorry he was assassinated. I was looking forward to voting against him in 1964, said how ashamed they were that this had happened. And they expressed concern about the climate of extremism. So that's the other side of it, an age of innocence, but also letters that remind us that it's still the age of segregation. There's a lot about the civil rights movement.
That really struck me. You know, now, decades later, there's all sorts of conspiracy theories. We have movies. There was a whiff of, you know, was it the communists or some, you know, the mafia or all these other theories. To a person, the letter writers that mentioned what they thought had happened were convinced it was because of Kennedy's push for civil rights.
Yes. This is a letter from Erie, Pennsylvania. The reason that all men mourn the death of your husband is because we feel we have played a part in his murder. We may not have been there, but we were all responsible because we did not fight with him in everything he stood for. We have wasted a great man. This was a surprise to me as a historian because historians have rightly been critical of President Kennedy for being very slow to protect the freedom riders, the civil rights workers in the South, and for being slow to initiate civil rights legislation. But his stance in favor of saying that this was a moral wrong powerfully impacted many citizens.
People write who lost husbands sometimes on the same... One woman, I remember a letter, her husband died while watching the coverage.
Yes.
So there's that section. You have letters from African Americans, letters from children. For others, it was they felt they knew the family.
They had the youngest children in the White House in the 20th century at a time when the post-World War II generation was raising the baby boomers. It was a point of commonality, as was President Kennedy's service during World War II. There was a sense, ironically, given their social class, their wealth, of a commonality with the American people.
There are letters from people who, so many of them started off by saying, I'm just a nobody.
That was the line that I read more often than any single line
right.
Other than I'm terribly sorry. I am a nobody from nowhere. And it saddened me to think about people who thought of themselves in those terms. There's one letter that I absolutely love. He begins by saying, I am but a humble postman. He's Henry Gonzalez from El Paso, Texas. So a sense of, I'm not anybody important, but I'm writing to you, even though you're a great lady and an important person, because I'm moved to do so.
And that's another element. I mean, you were hoping that you'd get some snapshot of the day. And in fact, people thought of themselves as reporters. Mrs. Kennedy, I have to tell you what happened, the street I was walking on, the postal route I was delivering.
This was something that people said happened to me. It changed my own life. It wasn't the president, the nation. It happened to me.
Historian Ellen Fitzpatrick at the JFK Library in Boston. Her book is Letters to Jackie. We'll have the whole evening at our website, herenow.org. But next we want to focus on one letter that also tells of another tragedy in 1963, the sinking of the nuclear sub, the Thresher. In 1 minute, Here and Now. Welcome back.
Dear Mrs. Kennedy, my deepest sympathy on the tragic loss of your husband.
One of the many letters in historian Ellen Fitzpatrick's new book, Letters to Jackie, came from a Mrs. John Wiley and referenced the sinking of the nuclear-powered sub, the USS Thresher, off the coast of Cape Cod just months before Kennedy's death. All 129 aboard, including her husband, a recent graduate of Annapolis, died. We want to know more about this tragic event, which had been eclipsed by the assassination. So we tracked down Mrs. Wiley, now Mrs. Pat Wiley Kelleher, and asked her to read her letter to Jackie.
On April 25th, 1963, I received a letter from your husband expressing his sympathy on the loss of my husband, an officer aboard the USS Thresher, which sank April 10th, 1963. Quote, it is a sad fact of history that this price of freedom must be paid again and again by our best young men in each generation. Your husband has joined the other defenders of this nation who has given their lives for their country. Unquote. My dear Mrs. Kennedy, this truly is your husband. I pray for you, Mrs. Kennedy, and our husbands. When you are very much alone with only your thoughts, please, please think of us, the wives of the Thresher left behind. Our hands reach out for yours in those moments of darkness. Most sincerely, Mrs. John J. Wiley.
Is it still horror for you?
Oh, yeah. You know, as much as this is a part of history, it's very personal.
Well, tell us more about what happened. A nuclear sub with your husband and 128 others. What happened?
Technologically, this submarine was the most advanced and was also a sub that helped to neutralize the threat of the Soviet submarines. It was thought of as, you know, this invincible, this invincible ship that those who were aboard truly, truly wanted to be there and felt it a great privilege to be a part of this fleet and set to sea April 9th with great excitement and great enthusiasm and all the confidence in the world. And on the morning of the 10th, it started to go into a test dive. And when it got to about 1,000 feet, there was a leak and tremendous spray of mist and fog came into the engine room. And with that, the reactor shut down. And one would imagine that the backup diesel power came into play, but by then it had sunk to a deeper depth. And at that point, the amount of power that it would take for that sub to come up was not enough. And the water pressure forced it down, and it broke apart. There was some description of what that sounded like. And, of course, I've replayed the possibility of hearing that sound, this tremendous breakup vacuum sound, 1,000 times, what that must have been like. But it really was that evening, 7 o'clock in the evening, it was Walter Cronkite who told us. Walter Cronkite was the first person who told us what had happened.
Also the first person who told many Americans about Kennedy.
That was a,
You know, I have to say, it's you've remarried. You have a beautiful life. And yet I can still see how you're wrestling with telling the story of what happened in 1963. What a horror.
It was 47 years ago. And I often, when I think about it, and I do think about it, it brings that reaction that I initially experienced.
What was it like to get the letter from President Kennedy expressing sympathy?
A moment of great stillness and silence for me, of just trying to get, I guess, some sense of what this all was about. The enormity of this is something that happened in history, well reported. Books came out later, even songs. I remember of driving in Washington, D.C., and suddenly on the radio came the Kingston Trio singing the Ballad of the Thresher. And, you know, I had to pull over to the side of the road and collect myself. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of, I guess, what was brought home to me with Kennedy's letter, is that this is something beyond me.
And then you find yourself writing a letter to his widow.
I guess it, you know, came from a true experience of feeling that way towards her, of knowing what this meant in the larger sense, not only her private loss, but the public loss, the way all of us felt.
But you didn't know if Jackie received it. And then fast forward 47 years, you hear from historian Ellen Fitzpatrick asking permission to use your letter, which she'd found at the JFK Library, which meant that it had been read, it had been archived, it mattered.
It was like the moment that I got President Kennedy's letter. It was, oh, this is bigger than me. This is history. It really helps in the letting go, in seeing this in a bigger way, because we can hang on to our private losses so deeply, and that's not always the best way to heal. He was, I feel, an exceptional human being in so many ways, and always kept him to myself, in a way, these last 47 years. So in a way, I guess I've translated this to, you know, to one last goodbye, I guess.
Pat Kelleher, her late husband John Wiley, died aboard the Thresher in an incident that led to improvements in sub safety.
Oh, the Thresher, the finest atomic ship that ever dived for the sea.
Back after the latest news, here and now.
Was a volunteer, was there because he chose there to be.
I'm Robin Young, it's Here and Now. That can only mean one thing. Post time is approaching for tomorrow's 136th running of the Kentucky Derby, the first jewel in horse racing's Triple Crown. A field of 20 horses is set for the Run for the Roses at Churchill Downs, but the pre-race favorite will not be among them. Escenderia was pulled from the field because of a leg injury. Joe Drape covers horse racing for the New York Times. Joe, I hate to start with an injury, you know, because we're so hypersensitive about them after the filly Eight Bells was euthanized on the track. She was hurt in the Kentucky Derby 2 years ago, and then Barbaro, who won in 2006, got hurt in the Preakness and eventually died. I mean, you and I have talked about how maybe owners were running the horses too hard. What's your thinking with this injury?
Robin, I think you're right. And awareness has been raised, and maybe 2 or 3 years ago, they don't scratch Escenderia from the race. But, you know, the world's watching. It's a different climate right now. People are very concerned about the welfare of these horses. This was a great horse that had won huge the last two outs in the Wood and the Fountain of Youth, was the favorite, really had people excited. But he came up with a bad ankle, and so they took him out, and they took him out early. So, you know, if there's a bright side, better now than 6:10 Saturday evening.
Right, so maybe this is a good thing. Well, who is your favorite going in tomorrow's race?
The favorite is my choice as well, and it's Looking at Lucky. And even before the big horse scratched, I liked this guy. He's the 2-year-old champion from last year, trained by Bob Baffert, who's won this race three times already and a Hall of Famer, has won 6 of 8 lifetime, and is really a handy, neat little horse. And I think he has all the things necessary, grit, heart, speed, seasoning, to really best this field. And I'm so hopeful, Robin, that, you know, if he gets by tomorrow, I think we're looking at a potential Triple Crown champ, which is something we haven't had since 1978.
So a lot of people into looking at horse racing should be looking at Lucky, according to Joe Drape and the people who know these things. Well, Joe, it's going to be a sloppy track tomorrow. What impact will that have, weather-wise? Well, I mean,
you know, it's going to have a huge impact, Robin. Al Roker was out there on a horse today, and he predicted monsoons. and they're going to come in tonight and go all day long. Churchill's pretty good. They've done this 136 times. They're pretty good about keeping the track fairly dry and not really mucky and swampy. The last time they had a bad track was 2004, and Smarty Jones won that, and he was the favorite, so it really didn't take him out of his game. But, you know, for your listeners out there looking for horses that have done well in the mud, they include the filly, Devil May Care, Super Saver, who's my second choice, Patty Oprado, who's the luck of the Irish for all your Boston listeners right up there.
Well, there are Irish in our other cities that are listening as well. Go ahead.
No, I do know that. But so, you know, there a couple will jump up a little bit. But, you know, I don't like to make the weather a predicting point. At this time of the year, either these horses are good enough or they're not.
Well, finally, Joe, just very briefly, you wrote recently that where, you know, there in Kentucky, for sale signs on horse farms are as common as bluegrass. It sounds as if horse racing sort of follows the economy.
Absolutely. These are commodities. And just like the price of oil goes down, the price of horses go down with the economy. 265 farms for sale here. Auction sales 2 years ago, $800 million. This year, $400 million. The prices have cut in half, and, you know, they're really struggling with it. And if we're going to, the next 6 weeks, we're going to be talking a lot about this, because Escenderia was owned by a bankrupt stable. 2 weeks, we'll go to Pimlico Racetrack, that historical place, and they're under bankruptcy. The New York Racing Association said, look, we need to borrow money from the state or we may not be able to hold the Belmont. So, you know, it's declined. People don't have money for disposable things, disposable displays. Horses are not disposable, but disposable displays
of wealth, yeah.
Yeah.
Joe Drape, he covers horse racing for the New York Times. He's also the author of the terrific book, Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains, with the Smith Center Redmen. We'll link you to that interview at herenow.org. Joe, thanks as always, and enjoy your day.
And as they say here, happy Derby.
Okay. Coming up, A Fisherman's View of the Gulf, Here and Now. Welcome back. President Obama today said no new offshore oil drilling leases will be issued unless new technology is in place to prevent oil spills like the one threatening the Gulf Coast right now. The problem is no one's exactly sure yet what caused the oil rig explosion that created the spill. We spoke to Dow Jones reporter Angel Gonzalez as he was heading out to the spill. He told us people in the Gulf area are conflicted because some feel grateful to the oil industry.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing to see because a lot of people here also work in the oil industry, and they say it has been good for the place. I mean, they say it's also one of the factors why the economy here revived after Katrina. So people are surprised at what happened. I mean, they didn't expect this to happen ever. They're very accustomed to having a very familiar and very close relationship with the extraction of energy.
Well, some fishermen may not feel that way. They've been meeting around the clock to figure out what, if anything, they can do to save their livelihoods. Yesterday, we spoke with John Tezovich, an oysterman in Port Sulphur, Louisiana. He mentioned he'd been contacted by Mark Jones, a former Navy officer who helped direct the Navy's cleanup efforts after the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. Mark Jones is now in Louisiana. Mark, why did you reach out to these fishermen?
Well, I work in the commercial seafood industry, and you know, I grew up in a fishing town in Alaska, and fishermen are, in essence, my people. And I've done a lot of work with the guys down here in Louisiana. I did some stuff with them to help them out after Katrina. I mean, these are people I know. This is a lifestyle and culture that's part of me. And so this was something I had to do.
While you're watching this accident unfold, what were you thinking?
I was thinking that this is remarkably similar to what I experienced with the Valdez spill. With an event like this, there's kind of a way it proceeds, and I'm not trying to point fingers at anyone. Don't get me wrong, but people never understand how serious it can be and how quickly it's going to get to be that serious.
As we know, with this spill, a third leak was only recently discovered. Officials from BP had to readjust how much oil was gushing out of that well at the bottom of the sea. It's much more than they thought. Is that what you're talking about?
Everything that I saw here was quite rational in the sense that originally the response effort was about trying to find 11 people that they didn't know were alive or dead.
Right.
And that was entirely appropriate to do. The second was about trying to figure out how to shut the well down. Also entirely appropriate. So in terms of how and what the procedures were and what order they went in, absolutely done the way they should have been done. But oil on water, it takes on its own aspects. And frankly, it's been a long time since the United States has had a major oil spill. And so you have the situation for coastal communities and coastal inhabitants where they're going to be the folks who end up on the front line, because there isn't a real risk to anything but a limited number of things like birds and that sort of thing until the spilled oil starts to impact the shoreline. And that's where real damage takes place. And it's not just the physical damage of oil hitting the shoreline. That's bad, okay? What is even worse is that there is damage that occurs that may have little to do with the actual spill. The Exxon Valdez spill, although immense, only impacted about 10% of the state of Alaska's coastal waters. Yet the entire fishing industry throughout the strait, from Kotzebue to Ketchikan, ended up taking a huge economic hit because there was a perception that there was something wrong with Alaskan seafood. There wasn't, because the state authorities stepped in and stopped all fishing within the areas that were affected by the oil spill. But in the market, there was this perception that there was a problem, so people quit buying Alaskan seafood. I want to make sure that the message gets out from Louisiana's fishermen and seafood industry that there's nothing wrong with Louisiana seafood. This seafood is safe, and the folks in Louisiana and those coastal communities need people to continue to consume that product.
Well, and yet when you also reached out to them, it was about telling them how they could band together in a flotilla to head out and do something about the oil as it came in so it doesn't destroy things like oyster beds and shrimp farms.
Yes. I mean, one of the things we learned in Valdez is that fishermen are terrific at doing innovative response. No one knows the waterways of Louisiana better than Louisiana's fishermen do. They know when a small channel has been changed by a windstorm or that some impact that has happened that you're never going to know that may have something very important to do with your response.
So what are you going to tell them to do today?
First of all, I've lived with fishermen all my life. Telling fishermen to do things is generally not a terribly effective thing to do. That's one of the things that becomes a problem in this sort of situation is that there's this cultural misunderstanding about how to deal with people that are knowledgeable, innovative, but very, very independent. And so I want to listen to them, and then we'll talk about what some options are.
And what might those be? I mean, John Tesvich was talking about trying to make booms and trying to do something to, you know, throwing out things that might soak up the oil. We learned horribly through Exxon Valdez that Dawn dishwashing liquid, you know, is good for, you know, trying to clean oil off of at least birds. And you and others have said that they're so great at, you know, coming up with their own improvising. So what might they be doing?
One of the things that we used fishermen for in Alaska very effectively is they were able to make their own little skimming systems and very effectively were able to work in shallow water picking up that floating oil so that it didn't impact another place.
Yeah.
And that's certainly something that I would like to look at here.
But by the way, you know, officials are saying that this is headed towards being worse than the Exxon Valdez spill. What is the state of Prince William Sound 21 years after that spill?
Depending on where you go in Prince William Sound, there are beaches you can go to and dig a 6-inch hole and it fills with oil. There are biological populations that never recovered. Now, depending on who you talk to, it was either because of the spill or not because of the spill or whatever, but the change is still there in place. And, of course, there's still very much a sense of caution by the residents of Prince William Sound, particularly the fishing community, about the activities of the oil companies.
Mark Jones, a former Navy officer, now a consultant for fisheries, who's headed to Grand Isle, Louisiana, to, as he said, listen to fishermen there and see if he can help. Mark Jones, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we'd love to hear from you. You can just go to hearnow.org, click on Contact Us in the upper right-hand corner to send an email or make a call, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage, hearandnow.org. When we come back, mezzo-soprano Stephanie Blythe, Here and Now. Welcome back. Before we go, we want to spend a few minutes with mezzo-soprano Stephanie Blythe. Why not? It could be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to speak with someone music critic Anthony Tomasini calls a once-in-a-generation opera singer. Here she is singing Bach's St. Matthew Passion. Stephanie Blythe has appeared on stages around the world. Tonight she's with Opera Boston in the title role of Offenbach's operetta, The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein. Here she is at a dress rehearsal earlier this week. And mezzo-soprano Stephanie Blythe also stopped by our studios. Mezzo-soprano, for those who know they love the music but still, you know, get some of the phrases mixed up, that is?
Well, a mezzo-soprano, literally, that means half soprano. But we don't like to go by that.
No halves.
So basically what it is it's where a woman's voice sits comfortably. A mezzo-soprano is a lower voice,
yeah,
where it's happiest, sitting it right there in the middle. Goes up to the top when it needs to, has a very secure lower range, but it's just where you feel comfortable singing.
It's where the tessitura.
That's exactly
is.
It. Very fine vocabulary, tessitura.
Which is, yes, where you're at your richest and your,
exactly,
most resonant. We have also read that there aren't as many roles for the mezzo-soprano because more roles are written for the soprano because more people like that. I have to say...
Oh, no, I don't think that's true.
I don't either.
No, I don't think that's true. I think that there are juicy roles written for every voice.
Right.
And I think that there's a lot of really wonderful repertoire for mezzo-sopranos. This particular role of La Grande Duchesse is one of those roles. It's a really, really meaty, fantastic part. What's challenging and exciting for me is, in, for instance, the first act. After I make my appearance in the first act, I never leave the stage. And I sing an aria and two major ensembles. So there's a lot of really, really wonderful music. What I enjoy the most is that it's such a terrific ensemble piece. There's so many wonderful ensembles. And while I enjoy being the title character, I much more enjoy being part of a texture.
First come to opera? When did it first seize you?
When I was 21.
How so?
Rather late.
That is late.
It is. It was rather late. I attended the State University of New York at Potsdam, where there's a really wonderful music school. And I was studying to be a music teacher and then decided after my first year and a half I wasn't very happy being a music teacher, that I knew someday I was going to wake up and say, I don't want to teach music.
Wait a minute. Did you have this voice or even a form of it then?
Yeah.
And you didn't, yes, know that you belonged on the stage or
no,
people around you didn't
no,
know?
No, the thing is when you're young, you don't, it takes you a little while to find your way. I mean, some people are very fortunate and they know immediately what they want and what they need and what they're great at. And I knew I had a gift, but I didn't take it seriously yet. I was just a kid. Hmm. I ended up becoming an English major and I got a degree in writing. And all the while, I was studying voice at the same time, and I was still doing performances, and I was still doing work at the music school, because the music school didn't know I wasn't a major anymore. And I didn't tell anybody, you know, so I took advantage of what I had. But around the time that I was 21, I decided that there was something there, and I wanted to find it. And I ended up changing voice teachers and finding someone who really worked, who knew my voice and understood me as a person, and who really helped me to get going. And then 3 years later, I was singing at the Met. So it went very, very quickly for me.
Did you have role models? Anybody you aspired to be like?
Yes, I wanted to be Placido Domingo, but,
that job was taken.
Completely different tessitura. Beyond just Placido's work, I loved the idea of being on stage and playing somebody else, being someone else, trying to figure out how a character works, how their brain works, how their singing works. And I was mesmerized by someone like him because he seemed to have all of the attributes that I really love about a performer: a really great vocal technique, a terrific voice, and an ability to be in the moment when performing. I tell you, the act of getting up on stage and performing, it's a very visceral, exciting act. The excitement is palpable, not just to the person experiencing it, but to the people in the audience.
Acclaimed mezzo-soprano Stephanie Blythe, I just want to ask you one question about your personal life, because it's interesting that, as you said, you came to opera late, so you had a life, you had lived a life before you entered what some would say is a very sort of rarefied air of opera. And I read that you are married to a former pro wrestler.
Yes.
Did you go to pro wrestling, and does he go to opera?
No, actually. well, that's not entirely true. I met my husband when I made my debut at the Paris Opera, and I was performing the role of Mistress Quickly in Falstaff. There's a very prominent supernumerary role, which is a non-singing acting role, known as the innkeeper in Falstaff. And my husband was playing that role. He's an Englishman who was living in Paris, and he was a retired professional wrestler and had fallen into doing super work at the opera. And we fell in love, and we were married a year later. And David still performs with me in many of the opera houses in which I work, including the Met, Seattle Opera. He's in this show with us as the major domo. So he's the head of my household here in Gerolstein. And we enjoy this very much because it gives us an opportunity to travel and be together all the time and to work together, which is really wonderful.
I love that.
Yeah.
Because there's also a sort of reminder that there are some people who have come to think of opera as something that's unreachable, when in fact it was the pro wrestling of its day. It's that entertaining.
Yes, it is incredibly entertaining.
Stephanie Blythe, she's appearing in Opera Boston's production of The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein. Stephanie, thanks so much.
Not at all. Thank you.
For more, go to hearandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service, NPRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.